Monster Man, Special Episode, Modrons. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're doing a special. This is a look at Modrons, requested by one of my Patreon supporters. Someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged $5 a month or more to support the show. Patrons who pledge at that level get to choose a special episode in which I discuss a monster of their choice. And we owe this episode to Patreon supporter Jake. Jake gave me a list of monsters to choose from, and I chose Modrons. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Jake, thank you very much for your support of Monster Man, and I hope you enjoy the show. In some of my previous episodes, I've maybe not done as good a job as I could of establishing what the monster is. And when you're talking about something like the Sphinx or the Troll, that's fine because everyone has kind of a basic understanding of what those things are. But for Modrons, I think we got to go into a little more detail. And in Dungeons & Dragons, there's a complex cosmology. Our world, the Prime Material Plane, exists within a network of other planes or dimensions, each of which has its own particular function. So there are elemental planes, like a plane of fire, and there are planes associated with other concepts. And among those planes are planes associated with alignments, the moral or cosmological positions of Dungeons & Dragons characters. So for example, there's a plane that is chaotic evil, there's a plane that is lawful evil, there's a plane that's neutral good, and this is the plane that is lawful neutral. We're talking about the plane that is in first edition AD&D called Nirvana, and in second edition and onwards it's called Mechanus. This is the plane of perfect order. It's a place where everything functions according to strict rules, hierarchies, and timetables, where there's no deviation, where, you know, it's basically a giant, perfectly functioning machine, which is, of course, why it's changed to Mechanus in later editions. Who would live in a place like this? Well, none other than the Modrons, although live is a bit debatable. Modrons are kind of, they're not necessarily robots, but they have some robot-like features. The lower-ranking Modrons, what are called base drones, are based on simple geometric shapes. So the monodrone is a sphere, for example. And then they have little arms and legs or wings attached to them so they can move around. And there are 5 levels of base drones. You got your monodrone, duodrone, tridrone, quadrone, and pentadrone. And then above them, there are 9 levels of hierarch Modrons, who are the officers and governors of the plane. So at the bottom, you've got the decaton, and then the nonaton, octon, septon, hexton, quinton, quarton, tertian, the 4 secundi, and then in the center of them all, Primus, the one and prime, the basically a god who controls the plane and rules over the Modrons. And the lower level drones are just that, drones. They're not very intelligent. So for example, a monodrone can only hold one thought in its head at a time. So if you tell a monodrone to attack, it will just run around attacking. And Modrons are creatures of perfect hierarchy. In fact, they can only perceive up to one level above them, right? I think they can perceive levels below them, because, for example, a pentadrone might be responsible for commanding a company of Modron troops that included mostly monodrones. So it'd have to be able to see them, but it can't see any higher than the decaton that would command it. Because to it, the decaton is a perfect embodiment of order and the will of Primus. Because the decaton is perfect, the pentadrone would obey it without question, and so on and so forth. Modrons are bad at communicating with player characters because Modrons are very bad at dealing with individuals. They're not really aware of the differences between individuals because they themselves are not that different from each other, right? As they can't tell non-Modrons apart. They can't really tell Modrons apart. It's just that that doesn't matter. If you're that pentadrone, you're never going to have to worry about getting ordered around by a decaton who's not your decaton, because if that happened, you should still obey it, right? So they're creatures of obedience and order and structure. Modrons originally appeared in the Monster Manual 2. It's 1983, and although the Monster Manual 2 does not have the specific monster credits that the Fiendfolio does, they are widely assumed to be the creations of François Marcel Froideval, who was a, well, who is a French game designer and comic creator who was working at TSR starting in 1982, or as a collaboration between Froideval and Gary Gygax. I think, to me, what the Modron structure resembles. So, obviously, the highly structured nature of Modron society is meant to reflect the fact that they are a lawful neutral species, if that's the right word. A lawful neutral society. That is to say that they are all about rules and regulations, and they don't particularly have a strong opinion on, like, good or evil. Right? They're not out to hurt anybody, but they don't care if people get hurt. That's not what's important to them. What's important to them is following the rules. And a great amount of detail is given in the Monster Manual and in later books to describing the kind of numerical structure of the Modron society, right? This is a mathematical precision to it all. And that, of course, makes sense because these are the creatures of perfect order. And I guess, you know, perfect order would be mathematical. What it reminds me of is the kind of apocryphal texts that spend a lot of time detailing the hierarchies of angels. You know, there are so many angels that answer to this angel, and there's so many angels that answer to this archangel, and they're divided into this many categories. And it was a great, like, fascination to the sort of late antique and medieval mind, this dividing things into explicitly numbered categories. I don't know why, other than that maybe that's not something that you would encounter a lot in real life in the Middle Ages, that you would live in a world that was kind of, you know, a little bit organic and a little bit rough, and where precision was an extremely, like, expensive and high status thing. You know, if you were in this, you know, monastery where everything was ordered according to exact mathematical principles, you'd be like, yeah, some real work and expense went into that. So maybe, you know, having a large number of the exact right number of things rather than just having whatever you could get was a symbol of status and authority for these writers. I don't know. Or maybe, you know, they were just sort of echoing the, like, legal structures of Roman or antique writing. You know, there's this many troops in a legion and there's that many officers and there's, you know, whatever. Even though, of course, in reality, those numbers are never really followed, right? Actual military units never quite live up to their paper strength, because real people get sick or go missing or are temporarily transferred to other things or blah, blah, blah. But of course, that wouldn't be true of Modrons or angels, right? I think even today, we look at perfect precision and we see that there's something kind of unnatural about it, or at least not normal, right? Whether that's superhuman or inhuman is left as an exercise for the reader. Now, I think that most Dungeons & Dragons fans in the modern day have a pretty positive impression of Modrons. I certainly have a good deal of affection for them, and I think that that is a function of when I started reading about them. Modrons appear in two main sources. I mentioned that they show up in the Monster Manual too, and then, of course, they're kind of re-detailed when Planescape comes out. Planescape is a Dungeons & Dragons setting that's very focused on adventuring in planes other than the one you're from. And our modern sense of what a Modron is very much comes from the Planescape box set that comes out in 1994. I'm reliably informed that some of the changes between Monster Manual 2 and Planescape box set actually occur in the Manual of the Planes, but since I have not read it, I just have to take my reliable sources' word for it. And I think that if you, you know, I never really played D&D when I was a kid. I started gaming with Tunnels and Trolls, then I played, like, Palladium games and Marvel Super Heroes, and then when I was in high school, I played, like, Call of Cthulhu, Paranoia, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, World of Darkness, things like that. So it wasn't until, really wasn't until 3rd Edition came out, whenever that was, late 90s, early 2000s, that I started playing D&D and kind of, like, going back and getting reacquainted with the classics. Well, not reacquainted, in my case, acquainted in the first place. You know, I had flipped through some D&D books, but I didn't really know all that much about the game. And so I come to Modrons when the default Modron, the understanding of Modrons, is the Planescape Modron. And I think that if that's where you started, you know, I think for most people, their first experience with Modrons is either the 1994 Planescape box set, or it's the video game Planescape Torment, in which one of the characters that you can add to your party is a guy called Nordom, who's a broken Modron. He's a quadrone, a cube Modron, and voiced by Dan Castellaneta. And I think most people who encountered Modrons under those conditions tend to have a pretty positive view of them, but maybe people who read them in the Monster Manual 2 were not as big fans. And I think that that's understandable if you look at the two entries, but it's also very interesting because Modrons in the Monster Manual 2 and Modrons in the Planescape box set, not actually all that different from each other. They're just really kind of three crucial distinctions, or maybe it's more than three. So first, the big difference between the Monster Manual 2 and Planescape in terms of the kind of quote-unquote facts, the fictional facts of the setting, is the rebranding of Nirvana, which is what the plane is called in Monster Manual 2, to Mechanus. And this makes a lot more sense, right? Mechanus is a better description of the structured society of this plane, and it's aesthetically just kind of more fun. It gives you, just in the name, it gives you some kind of sense of what's going on in that plane, whereas Nirvana, at least for me, gives you an impression of, you know, people living in untroubled bliss, which does not necessarily feel like it presents a lot of opportunities for adventure. You know, well, this week we're going to the land of untroubled bliss. To do what? Now, Nirvana in Dungeons & Dragons is not a land of untroubled bliss, which makes Nirvana a really weird name for it. That's one. The second is that the Planescape box set goes into a little bit more detail, but really only a little, but a little bit more detail about how Modrons think, or if think is the right word, how Modrons experience the world and how they interact with others. Again, I think with the assumption that either you're going to be encountering Modrons as you, you know, actually visit Mechanus, or that, you know, you're going to, in your travels around other planes, encounter Modron parties exploring or carrying out missions for Primus or whatever. And the third one, and I think this is really crucial, is the art. Now, I try not to be too critical of the art in older books. For one thing, I really tend to like it. And for another, you know, this isn't one of those podcasts where I just make fun of things from the 70s or 80s, ha-ha, you know, am I more sophisticated with my modern tastes that I'll look back on in 10 years and regret. But I have to say that the art in the Modron section of the Monster Manual 2 is not the artist's best work. And it's an artist, well, it's two artists, but the base drones, the first four Modrons, the kind of more geometric Modrons, are the work of an artist that I usually really like for a couple of reasons. And the first is that he has the same name as me. I'm talking about James Holloway. He is sometimes credited in the 80s, in fact, I think more usually credited over at TSR, as Jim Holloway, and he did a lot of work for TSR back in the day, but I think he's probably best known as the artist who gave a distinctive look to the first and second editions of Paranoia, and he has this kind of very expressive style. He's very good at human facial expressions. You know, typically he's quite a naturalistic artist, and I think that his style is just kind of an awkward mesh with the description of the Modrons. Now, this works to a certain extent because the Modrons are meant to be freaky and alien-looking, and if I wanted to voice a criticism of the later depictions of Modrons, I would say is that they look too familiar, right? We all know what funny little robots are like, and we can look at a Modron and go, oh, it's a funny little robot, rather than looking at, you know, a Modron as they appear in Monster Manual 2 and going, what in the blazes is that? Which is sort of what you should think when you see a creature from another plane. But at the same time, we have to give the imagination something to hook onto. So the first four Modrons are not fantastic. It just, I don't know, they look sort of hastily thrown together, or maybe like, you know, a little bit like someone's trying to draw some mythos horror, but only from description. Then we have the higher Modrons, the pentadrones up through the Hierarch Modrons and Primus, the one in the Prime, and I believe those illustrations are by Dave Sutherland. Now, normally, I'm not a fan of Dave Sutherland. You know, like, I say that in general, but then every time I mention Dave Sutherland on this podcast is because I like some piece of his art, so maybe I need to reevaluate him. And I think that the Hierarch Modrons actually look pretty good, especially the ones who have some kind of, like, they have these, like, propeller collars around their necks that allow them to both swim and fly, and those are pretty cool. And there they just look like, here's an alien species. And the only problem with them is that they don't look very compatible with the base drones drawn by Holloway, right? They don't really all look like they're the same type of thing. The pentadrone looks like a weird flower. It's meant to look like a pentagram, I guess, or like a five-pointed star. It doesn't look like a pentagon, certainly. I don't know what it is. It doesn't look bad. It looks like a cool, crazy alien, but it doesn't fit with the other ones. And so I feel like maybe there wasn't as much visual inspiration in the Holloway and Sutherland Modrons as there might have been, and maybe that it needed a push from the visuals to put a kind of weird concept over with the gamers. Now, here's a note from James from the future. Later on in this podcast, I'm probably going to call the Monster Manual 2 Modrons Holloway Modrons, and of course, you should think that they are Holloway Sutherland Modrons. But the first time I read the section, I looked at the art for the first few ones, and I went, oh, right, well, that's Jim Holloway. He's a very recognizable style. And then somehow it didn't occur to me that the later, quite different-looking ones would be by a different person, that they actually changed artists in the middle of the section. And I don't know why I didn't think about that, because that's actually true of most of the longer multi-monster sections in TSR Monster Books. You can see in the Fiend Folio as well. So, no excuse. You can see the Monster Manual, heck. So later on in this podcast, if I say Holloway Modrons, please assume that I mean Holloway and Sutherland. Thank you. So, I think, unfortunately, the Modron art in the Monster Manual 2, while it is suitably weird, you know, it really does give you a sense that Modrons are these bizarre creatures, but what it doesn't do is make them interesting or relatable. And the Planescape box changes that by giving the art job to Tony DiTerlizzi, whose kind of fairy tale-y, children's booky kind of style is perfect for these weird creatures. And I think the characterization of Modrons is largely based on DiTerlizzi's art, because like I said, there isn't that much of a difference between the way they're described in the Planescape box set and the way they're described in Monster Manual 2. But DiTerlizzi gives them like these big eyes that even bigger than, you know, they are in Holloway, and that they like take up most of the sphere in the case of a monodrone. And that gives them this sense of neoteny, which lets you think of the Modrons as being kind of naive. And that makes sense that these lawful neutral rule enforcers just kind of blindly following their instructions are kind of bumbling. And that makes Modrons lovable, right? DiTerlizzi also adds mechanical bits to them, in line with the rebranding of Nirvana as mechanists. And I think that today, that is what people think of when they see Modrons. It's some kind of like it's an organic creature, but it's got these mechanical sort of steampunky components. And that goes hand in hand with its sort of inability to understand, you know, emotion or spontaneity. It's a robot, even though they're not robots per se, they're Modrons. Once you have those, I think you have the Modrons that most people know and love, right? Clanky, servants of order who are kind of actually slightly goofy and bumbling, and are bound as much as empowered by the rules that they follow. So those are Modrons, and that's why Modrons are fun. Now, how do you use Modrons in your game? Because I do think that engagement is one of the big problems of the Modron, right? For the most part, you're not gonna go to Nirvana or Mechanus unless you are running a plane-hopping game. But if you're running a regular old D&D game, Modrons are just very unlikely to come up. That's true of a lot of the kind of planar creatures, but things like demons and devils, for instance, have much more concrete agendas that require our world for some reason, right? Whether that's just harvesting souls or advancing their ideological mission to spread evil. But that's not really how things work in Nirvana stroke Mechanus. Mechanus is better, by the way, and even if you're running an AD&D first edition game, you should import that bit of the second edition setting back. It is hard to see what they do outside their plane. Similarly, why would, you know, characters who aren't from Mechanus stroke Nirvana go there? And it doesn't seem like there would be something that they want there, right? So Modrons are going to take some work to engineer into your D&D game. I do think that one of the things you can do is play up the idea that Modrons are very alien, right? They fit in the world much less comfortably than most other monsters, right? They don't really fit with the game's medieval or pulp fantasy aesthetic. I would argue that they fit less well even then, like the crashed spaceship in Expedition to the Barrier Peaks. But in a way, that's part of their genius, because they are, in fact, extraplanar entities. They come from a world that has very different rules, and they come from a world that makes sense in a very different way. So the kind of discombobulation that players can feel encountering Modrons should, you know, is a good thing because it reflects the way that the characters would also feel, that this really is something outside their experience and something that they feel kind of uncomfortable with. So your options are simple. First, you could be having an adventure that is set in Mechanus for whatever reason, right? Your characters have to collect, you know, all the gubbins of the staff of many gubbins, and that means going to all different planes and collecting an ingredient from each, and they got to get around the Modrons. And there, I think, you know, there are actually, the Modrons are kind of fun in a fight, to be honest. At two levels. First, like I said, there are 14 different types of Modron, excluding Primus, and a lot of them have some kind of clever thing that they can do that makes them different. So you have a full suite of different types of ability that you can deploy, even while maintaining the theme of, hey, we're mainly going to be fighting Modrons. Secondly, at the low level, when you're just fighting like monodrones and duodrones and so forth, you do get a fun thing where, because they're kind of simple creatures, like I mentioned before that monodrones are single-minded. They can only really think of one thing at a time. And so that means that you can do some clever things with exploiting the weaknesses of the opponent's programming, which is simple enough that players can actually do it in a game and relates to their theme in a way that will make the players happy. So that's cool. You could also play the whole thing up as a kind of, you know, Terry Gilliam-esque bureaucracy encounter, because Modrons are very, very bureaucratic and also can't tell non-Modrons apart, you know, other than maybe in terms of their categories, right? So you can sort of see that, like, if someone comes in and they're like, oh, you know, we spoke earlier, half-elf female. You know, look, I'm a different half-elf female. I'm sorry, what? Like, that could be a lot of fun, too. So that's one, is bureaucracy run around and or robot fights in the plane of Mechanus itself. And you could do some fun things with, you know, what's in Mechanus, right? So just like, it has this very elaborate hierarchy, basically. It's a city structured of, like, interlocking gears, so you could do some neat things with the landscape. And you could really play up, if you're visiting a bunch of different planes, then you really want to play up the differences between them, so you could do a lot of fun stuff with, like, all the crazy stuff that you can expect to find in Mechanus. The second is that Modrons do make planned excursions from Mechanus. And there's actually a whole scenario pack about this called the Great Modron March, which is about, like, once every 17-year cycles, the Modrons send out, like, an expeditionary force that does a grand tour of the planes along a fixed itinerary, just looking at things. And they succumb to all kinds of hazards along the way, but because of the way that Modron promotion works, is when a Modron dies, another Modron from a lower rank is transformed into a Modron of the next available rank. So, you know, if an Octon dies, a Nonaton suddenly becomes an Octon, a Decaton suddenly becomes a Nonaton, a Pentadrone suddenly becomes a Decaton, and so on and so forth. So because that happens, the leader of this Modron army pretty much always survives, because, you know, if he dies, another one just gets promoted to take his place until finally there's only one of them left. That's not 100% true. You could theoretically kill off all the Monodrones, because Monodrones, there's no one below them. So, you know, the tactic of attacking the leaders is the wrong way to fight Modrons, which is also a fun detail. So they go around and they just, like, they have this migration. So all along the way, weird stuff happens. You know, people are trying to capture them. People who are ideological adherents of chaos are trying to persuade them to go rogue, which does happen. There are rogue Modrons, who are also a fun thing. In fact, I think probably, you know, rogue Modrons maybe have more story potential than regular Modrons. And then the premise of this scenario, though, is that the migration happens, or the march happens at the wrong time. And this is a really good thing. When you have characters like Modrons who are described as, you know, perfectly embodying order, then the easiest way in the world to, like, gin up some alarm about how things aren't going the way they should is to say, oh yeah, they're doing the wrong thing. Modrons don't act contrary to their programming. So if the Great Modron March is happening at the wrong time, something is very wrong. Now, the thing that is very wrong in the Great Modron March happens to be promo material for another scenario pack. Metaplot. Not even once. But it was the 90s, you know, that's how they did it back then. So that's the second one, is that Modrons make some kind of organized excursion onto another plane. And the third way to include Modrons in a D&D game, I think this one's my personal favorite, is that you assume that, like, they're lost, right? So creatures from other planes can wind up on the Prime Material plane, however. So what would a bunch of Modrons do on the Prime Material plane? Well, they would start trying to organize it, right? They want to make it orderly. So, you know, you just have, like, a little cell of Modrons, you know, have somehow crash-landed on the Prime Material plane, and they've decided that, you know, look at this, it's chaos, we're gonna pave the Earth. That's terrific, because presumably what they would start doing is building their own little, like, replica of Mechanus, you know, and all of a sudden what you've got is a bunch of goofy robots just trying to terraform whatever piece of wilderness or little village they've crash-landed in, and you gotta kind of go in there, and you get to have this little weird pocket environment. I mean, what they would build, this strange little city of gears and straight lines and planes and whatever, would ultimately be kind of like a strange little dungeon, and you'd either have to fight a bunch of them or maybe figure out a way to just get them back to Mechanus and out of everybody's hair. And that, I think, is a fun Modron scenario, because largely because of Tony Terlizzi's art, Modrons are quite sympathetic characters. I think people don't want to fight them in the main. They see them as amusing, bumbling robots. And maybe it's because we have such a, like, ingrained cultural sense of amusing bumbling robots as a thing as well. So those last two scenario concepts have this thing where the agency is largely with the Modrons. Another thing to do is to cast the Modrons as victims, because Modrons, while highly intelligent, have these kind of blind spots in their orderly nature that you could see might lead to them being duped by a bad guy into serving as his kind of shock troops, you know, some lawful evil guy tricking these lawful neutral robots into helping him out. Or maybe, you know, somebody wants to build a magic item that's aligned with Mechanus stroke Nirvana and therefore requires a bunch of Modron parts to make. And so you might have Modrons in a kind of victim role. And those would be other ways in which the PCs would kind of have to struggle to, like, aid or protect creatures who don't necessarily have the clearest understanding of what that help or protection involves, particularly if the PCs, like most PC groups, are more over on the chaotic side of things, whether by alignment or just inclination. They might fit quite uneasily with a group of Modrons, and that gives you, like, the humor potential of, you know, frustrating interactions with Modrons in Mechanus without having to have an entire scenario that's all about, like, filling out forms in triplicates and fighting bowling balls armed with faux shards. I do like that it specifies they're armed with faux shards. A faux shard, by the way, is a bit like a bill, except that the cutting edge is the other side, so the back curve of the blade, like the hook part, is the sharp bit. But honestly, polearm terminology, all these words just mean pole arm. Don't let them fool you. Anyway, any way that you are going to use Modrons, you want to focus on their orderliness, right? That's their distinctive characteristic, is their orderliness and their desire to impose order on the rest of the world. Because it's such a silly, unachievable, quixotic kind of dream. Quixotic? Do we say quixotic or quixotic? I mean, it's Quixote, obviously. I don't know. Anyway, that kind of a dream, that there's something charming about it, even though we would not like the results if they actually succeeded. So any scenario about Modrons ultimately has to be a scenario about order and its consequences, whether those consequences are that it's an ice cream headache trying to, you know, get anything done in the world of Mechanus, or that the, you know, warm, productive chaos of nature or human lives and families is being overridden by the soulless order of these Modrons. Of these, from their perspective, well-meaning Modrons. And I think that that's it, right? If you can capture that feel that makes Modrons well-meaning, then I think you've got an effective Modron scenario. And a big part of that is visual, honestly. Unfortunately, this is not a visual format, but if you look at the show notes, either on Libsyn or on Patreon, I'll try to put some up on my Twitter and other social media as well. I'm going to try to include some contrast images that show the Jim Holloway and Tony Terlizzi Modron images. I'm a little surprised that I don't have any Modron miniatures. Off the top of my head, I don't think there are a lot of them, but I also wonder if it's not because Modron legs are so spindly that they're not manufactured in many media. Like, to me, they seem to be a popular D&D monster, so you'd think I would have seen more Modron miniatures, but I certainly don't have any, and I'm not aware that they exist in the official D&D line, but I'm sure somebody makes one. But if you or your company make a Modron miniature, let me know. Maybe it's just because there are 14 different types of them. That is quite a lot. Another thing that always comes up when you're talking about Modrons is the possibility of player character Modrons, right? So in the description of Modrons, they talk about rogue Modrons, Modrons that have become separated from the kind of collective hive mind societal structure of Mechanus. Naturally, people are going to want to play these guys, and several editions of D&D have, certainly Third does, have Modrons as, and maybe Second as well, have Modrons as a player character race. I think this can be a real challenge, right? Modron psychology is extremely alien. Even a rogue Modron should be very, very different from a human. And if you've played Planescape Torment, which, full disclosure, I have not, but I looked up a bunch of stuff about Nordum as research for this episode, you know, Nordum is very weird, and that's what people like about him, is that he's so different from kind of what you would expect. But that kind of character can be very difficult to play well, because if you make them too similar to a person, they're just a regular PC with a dumb gimmick. And if you make them too different from a person, then they run the risk of being, oh, I am the wacky Modron character, which you also don't like. I mean, that kind of, and that is the kind of thing. It would not surprise me to find that I am the wacky Modron character type PCs are often played by people who are normally DMs, because that's an NPC concept, right? Nordum is an NPC, and everybody loves him as an NPC. And I don't think he works. I don't want to say I don't think he works, but I think he's quite difficult to pull off as a player character. Some DMs, and I am one of them, have this bad habit that we design player characters who maybe make more sense as NPCs, right? People who are explorations of a specific concept. Because I think that a rogue Modron NPC is very likely to be a MacGuffin, right? He's going to be someone that the other Modrons want back or want destroyed, because he threatens the orderly structure of Mechanus stroke Nirvana. And then the PCs wind up with this choice, which is, you know, do they protect him against these Modrons? Do they leave the Modrons to sort out their own internal business? What if, as maybe makes sense, the rogue Modron is maybe not such a great guy, right? Like, just because he's rebelled against this orderly system doesn't mean that he's, you know, that he's so wonderful. He might be chaotic evil. So the idea of, like, a rogue Modron, like, stumbling into the player character's camp and going, Rick, you must help me, Rick. You know, that's a fun idea. And I think that's another good Modron scenario hook. It's, you know, hunting down a rogue, if that's what Modrons do, is a good Modron scenario idea. It's a good reason for hunting down a rogue. Could be a good reason for a group of Modrons to leave Mechanus and go interact with player characters on another plane. But as for a player character rogue Modron, I think you'd have to be very cautious, because there's just a lot of potential for him to be kind of a one-note, goofy concept. I mean, maybe no goofier than your average barbarian, so what do I know? You know, go for it if that's what you're into. Anyway, those are Modrons. I hope that that's been an entertaining exploration of their history and their use in games. I hope that you enjoyed it. If you did, perhaps you too would consider sponsoring Monster Man on Patreon. If you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the Deities and Demigods book. And if you pledge at the $5 or higher level, then just like Jake, you too will get to choose a monster for a special episode. But whether you do or don't, thank you very much for listening to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory, or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monstermanpod. Monster Man, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.